A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a question I think a lot of people have wrestled with, but maybe haven't articulated quite this clearly. He's noticed something in people he's known over the years. Some folks seem to have a depression that's cognitively driven, where they go through a rough patch, and you can practically see the thought patterns pulling them down, and therapy that works on those cognitions seems to help. Then, there are others where the depression feels more like it's baked into their constitution, almost like a personality trait, and no amount of cognitive work seems to touch it. So, his question is, are there actually recognized subtypes that map to this distinction? And, from a scientific angle, what do we actually know about depression that's more biological or neurochemical, in origin versus depression that's more psychologically driven? He's asking whether some people really do have a version of this that's only going to respond to medication, or even electroconvulsive therapy, because it's fundamentally a chemical problem.
This is one of those questions where the intuitive distinction people make in everyday life actually has a surprisingly long history in psychiatry, though the field has wrestled with it and reframed it multiple times. And I should say, before we really get into the science, fun fact, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today.
I hope it's up on its neurochemistry, because this could get dense.
The place to start is that the distinction Daniel is drawing maps pretty closely to what psychiatry historically called reactive versus endogenous depression. Reactive depression was understood as a response to external stressors, loss, adversity. Endogenous depression was the one that seemed to arise from within, without an obvious trigger, and it was thought to be more biological, more severe, and more likely to respond to somatic treatments like medication or ECT.
Is that distinction still used?
The DSM dropped it decades ago. But unofficially, the ghost of it is still wandering around clinical practice and research. The DSM-5 doesn't use endogenous versus reactive as categories. Instead, it has specifiers, additional labels you can attach to a diagnosis of major depressive disorder to characterize the presentation more precisely. And some of these specifiers capture pieces of what Daniel is describing.
They killed the old categories, but kept the clinical intuition under new names. What are the specifiers?
The one most relevant here is melancholic features. Melancholic depression is characterized by a profound loss of pleasure in almost all activities. Anhedonia, a lack of mood reactivity, so even good things happening don't lift the mood. A distinct quality of depressed mood that feels qualitatively different from ordinary sadness, depression that's worse in the morning, early morning awakening, significant psychomotor changes, and often significant weight loss. And here's the key connection to Daniel's question. Melancholic depression is the one most consistently linked to biological abnormalities. People with melancholic features tend to show hypercortisolemia, elevated cortisol, and they're more likely to show a non-suppression response on the dexamethasone suppression test, which measures how the body's stress hormone system is functioning.
Wait, unpack that. The dexamethasone test, what's actually happening there biologically?
Normally, if you give someone dexamethasone, a synthetic glucocorticoid, their body's feedback system says we've got plenty of steroid on board, shut down cortisol production. In a healthy person, cortisol levels drop and stay suppressed. But in a significant portion of people with melancholic depression, that feedback loop is broken. You give them dexamethasone and their cortisol keeps pumping out anyway. It's a sign that the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, the HPA axis, is dysregulated. This is one of the most replicated biological findings in all of psychiatry, and it's specifically associated with the melancholic subtype.
There's a measurable physical thing going on. It's not just a metaphor to say some depression is biological.
This connects to something else Daniel mentioned, the idea that some people's depression seems embedded in their personality. There's a recognized pattern here too. It's not a DSM specifier in quite the same way, but there's a concept called depressive personality disorder that was studied for inclusion and ultimately placed in the appendix for further study. More broadly, there's dysthymia, now called persistent depressive disorder in the DSM-5. This is a chronic, lower-grade depression lasting at least 2 years, often much longer. People with it frequently describe it as just who they are. They might say, "I've always been this way."
Which is exactly the kind of thing Daniel was describing. Depression that feels like a personality feature rather than an episode.
Here's what's interesting. Persistent depressive disorder and melancholic depression are not mutually exclusive, but they highlight different aspects of what Daniel is noticing. The melancholic specifier gets at the biological severity piece, the neurochemical dysregulation, the HPA axis abnormalities, the strong response to biological treatments. The chronicity of persistent depressive disorder gets at the embedded in-personality piece.
Let me push on something. Daniel's question implies a binary. The cognitive type where therapy works, and the biological type where only drugs or ECT help. Is the science actually that clean?
No, and this is where a lot of public understanding goes wrong. The idea that you can neatly divide depression into psychological versus biological is a false dichotomy. Every psychological state has a biological correlate. When someone goes through cognitive behavioral therapy and gets better, their brain is physically changing. Neuroimaging studies show CBT produces measurable changes in brain activity, particularly in the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. Therapy is a biological intervention. It's just delivered through learning and cognition rather than through a molecule.
That's a useful reframe. The distinction isn't biological versus non-biological. It's about which biological pathway you're targeting.
And similarly, if an antidepressant lifts someone's mood, that changes their cognitions too. They start thinking differently, interpreting situations differently. The arrows go both ways.
What does the research actually say about who responds to what? If Daniel has a friend who seems constitutionally depressed, and therapy hasn't done much, is there a scientific basis for saying this person probably needs medication?
There is evidence, though it's messier than most people would like. The melancholic subtype is consistently associated with a poorer response to psychotherapy alone and a better response to biological treatments. A meta-analysis published a few years back found that people with melancholic features showed less improvement with CBT or interpersonal therapy compared to non-melancholic depression, but they responded reasonably well to antidepressants and particularly well to ECT.
What about the other direction? Are there subtypes that respond particularly well to therapy?
Atypical depression is the one often cited here, and the name is misleading. It's actually quite common. It's characterized by mood reactivity, so the person can feel better temporarily when something good happens, plus increased appetite, weight gain, excessive sleep, a heavy leaden feeling in the limbs, and long-standing rejection sensitivity. People with atypical features tend to show a different biological profile, often normal or even low cortisol, unlike the high cortisol in melancholic depression. Some studies suggest they respond better to monoamine oxidase inhibitors and possibly to psychotherapy, though the therapy response evidence is less robust than the melancholic data.
We've got melancholic on one end, more biological markers, poor therapy response, better medication, and ECT response. Atypical on the other end, different biology, possibly more responsive to certain medications and therapy. And a whole lot of people in the middle who don't fit neatly into either bucket.
That's exactly the landscape, and this is where I want to bring in a major shift in how researchers think about depression. The field has largely moved away from the idea that there's one or two or even five subtypes you can identify based on symptoms alone. There's a growing recognition that depression is probably not one disease at all. It's a syndrome, a collection of different conditions that happen to share a similar outward appearance.
Like how a fever can be caused by a bacterial infection, a virus, or an autoimmune flare. Same symptom, totally different underlying mechanisms.
That's the analogy. And this is where some of the most exciting research is happening. Large-scale studies are now trying to identify biotypes of depression, subtypes defined not by how people describe their symptoms, but by underlying biology. They use functional MRI to look at brain circuit activity, genetic markers, inflammatory markers, hormone levels, and then use machine learning to cluster people based on these biological measures rather than on what they tell a clinician.
Do these biotypes map onto treatment response?
This is where it gets genuinely interesting. One landmark study out of Stanford, led by Leanne Williams, identified several biotypes based on patterns of brain connectivity. One biotype showed reduced connectivity in certain frontal limbic circuits and was characterized by anhedonia and cognitive slowing. Another showed hyperconnectivity in different circuits and was associated more with anxiety and rumination. Critically, these biotypes predicted treatment response differently. The reduced connectivity group responded better to a specific antidepressant, while the hyperconnectivity group did better with a different approach.
We're moving toward a world where you might be able to do a brain scan or a blood panel and say, your depression looks like this biologically, so let's start with this treatment first, rather than the current approach of trying things and seeing what sticks.
That's the vision. We're not there yet for routine clinical practice. These findings are still being validated, but the direction of travel is clear. And it directly addresses Daniel's question about whether some people's depression is fundamentally biological. The answer, from the cutting edge of the science, is that all depression is biological, but different people have different biologies driving their depression, and those differences matter enormously for what treatment will work.
Let me pull on another thread Daniel raised. He mentioned knowing people where you can do all the CBT work in the world, and it just doesn't seem to land. What's actually happening there mechanistically?
There are a few hypotheses. One is about cognitive remediation, the idea that in some forms of depression, particularly the more severe or melancholic types, there's an actual impairment in executive function that makes it very difficult to engage in the kind of cognitive restructuring that CBT requires. If your working memory is shot and your ability to shift mental sets is impaired, asking you to identify automatic thoughts and generate alternative interpretations is like asking someone with a broken leg to do physical therapy without first addressing the fracture.
The biological impairment in cognition blocks the very mechanism that cognitive therapy relies on.
And this connects to another finding. People with melancholic depression often show significant cognitive deficits. Problems with concentration, memory, decision-making that look almost like a reversible dementia in severe cases. It's sometimes called pseudo-dementia. These cognitive symptoms are strongly correlated with the HPA axis dysregulation I mentioned. High cortisol is toxic to the hippocampus, which is critical for memory and learning. So you've got this vicious cycle where the biological abnormality impairs the very cognitive functions you'd need to benefit from a cognitive intervention.
Which would explain why starting with medication to correct the underlying biology might then make someone more able to benefit from therapy.
That's exactly the sequencing many clinicians use for severe melancholic depression. Get the person to a place where their brain is functioning better biologically, then layer on the psychological work. It's not either or, it's about timing and sequence.
What about electroconvulsive therapy specifically? Daniel mentioned it, and it's a treatment that a lot of people have strong reactions to based on popular culture. What does the evidence actually say about when ECT is indicated?
ECT is one of the most effective treatments in all of psychiatry, and also one of the most misunderstood. For severe melancholic depression, particularly with psychotic features, ECT has response rates in the range of 80 to 90%, dramatically higher than antidepressants alone. It works faster, too. The mechanism isn't fully understood, but the leading hypothesis is that it induces a massive release of neurotrophic factors and resets the HPA axis dysregulation. It also promotes neurogenesis in the hippocampus, the same brain region damaged by chronic high cortisol.
Modern ECT is not what people picture from old movies.
Not at all. It's done under general anesthesia with muscle relaxants. The electrical stimulus is precisely calibrated. Unilateral electrode placement has dramatically reduced the cognitive side effects that were the major concern with older bilateral techniques. Most people report some short-term memory issues around the time of treatment, but persistent cognitive problems are much less common with modern protocols. It's still a serious treatment with real risks. But the risk-benefit calculus for someone with severe, treatment-resistant melancholic depression is very different from what popular culture would lead you to believe.
If Daniel's friend with the more constitutional, seemingly biological depression has tried multiple medications and therapy without success, ECT is not a desperate last resort, so much as a rational next step based on what we know about that subtype.
It should be on the table much earlier than it typically is. The stigma means many people suffer through years of ineffective treatments before they're offered something that might have helped them much sooner. And this brings me to another dimension we haven't touched, the role of inflammation. This has been one of the biggest stories in depression research over the past decade. There's now substantial evidence that a subset of people with depression have elevated inflammatory markers, C-reactive protein, interleukin-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha, and this inflammatory subtype seems associated with a particular clinical picture, more anhedonia, more fatigue, more cognitive slowing, and a poorer response to standard SSRI antidepressants.
It's another biological subtype hiding inside the big tent of depression.
It may help explain something Daniel alluded to, the confusing fact that life circumstances can exert biological effects on the brain. Chronic stress, early life adversity, social isolation, all of these can increase systemic inflammation. And systemic inflammation can cross the blood-brain barrier and affect brain function directly. Inflammatory cytokines can disrupt the production and metabolism of serotonin, dopamine, and glutamate. They can reduce neuroplasticity. So there's a pathway by which life circumstances literally change your brain biology in a way that looks like endogenous depression. The distinction between reactive and biological starts to dissolve.
That's both clarifying and unsettling. It means someone could start out with a depression that looks purely reactive to circumstances, but if it goes on long enough, the biology shifts and you're dealing with something that needs a biological intervention.
The term for this is neuroprogression. The idea is that repeated depressive episodes or chronic unremitting depression can cause cumulative damage to the brain over time. Each episode seems to increase the risk of future episodes. The intervals between episodes get shorter. The triggers needed to precipitate an episode get smaller. Eventually, episodes can start occurring without any apparent trigger at all, which looks exactly like the endogenous pattern.
The reactive can become the endogenous over time. The psychological can become the biological. Which means the clean categories Daniel was observing might actually reflect different points on a single trajectory, not fundamentally different kinds of people.
That's one interpretation, and there's evidence for it, but I don't want to overstate it. There are also people who seem to have a strongly biological depression from the very beginning, often with a strong family history, early onset, and the melancholic features we discussed. And there are people who have multiple depressive episodes over decades and never develop the melancholic pattern or the HPA axis dysregulation. So there are probably multiple pathways into depression, and they interact in complex ways.
Let's talk about genetics. If someone has the kind of depression that seems baked into their personality, is there a genetic component that's been identified?
Depression is heritable, but not in a simple way. Twin studies suggest heritability around 37%, lower than schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, but still significant. And it's polygenic. There isn't one depression gene. There are hundreds or thousands of genetic variants, each contributing a tiny amount of risk. Some are involved in serotonin and dopamine signaling, others in HPA axis regulation, others in neuroplasticity and inflammation. So genetically, depression isn't one thing either.
Are there genetic patterns that distinguish the more biological melancholic type from the more reactive type?
There's some early evidence. Studies looking at polygenic risk scores have found that melancholic depression may have a somewhat different genetic architecture than non-melancholic depression. Melancholic depression seems to share more genetic overlap with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, conditions with clearer biological underpinnings. Non-melancholic depression shares more genetic overlap with anxiety disorders and neuroticism, a personality trait characterized by a tendency toward negative emotionality.
Neuroticism. That's interesting in light of Daniel's observation about depression, seeming embedded in personality for some people.
Neuroticism is one of the big five personality traits, and it's strongly associated with depression risk. People high in neuroticism tend to experience negative emotions more intensely and more frequently. They're more reactive to stress. And neuroticism itself is partly heritable and partly shaped by early environment. So someone could have a genetically influenced tendency toward negative emotionality, experience adverse childhood events that reinforce that tendency, develop depression that becomes chronic, and over time, the biological changes from the chronic depression further entrench the pattern. By the time you meet them as an adult, it looks like it's just who they are, and in a sense, it is who they've become, through a complex interplay of genes, environment, and the biological consequences of their own mental states over time.
That's a much more nuanced picture than the simple chemical imbalance story that got popularized.
The chemical imbalance theory, the idea that depression is simply caused by low serotonin, was never actually the scientific consensus. It was a useful simplification for public communication that got out of hand. The reality is that depression involves multiple neurotransmitter systems, hormonal systems, inflammatory pathways, neural circuits, and structural brain changes, all interacting with each other and with the person's environment and psychology. Serotonin is involved, but it's one player in a very large cast.
The SSRIs that target serotonin, they work, but not for everyone, and the mechanism is probably more complicated than just boosting serotonin levels.
Much more complicated. SSRIs increase serotonin availability within hours of the first dose, but the antidepressant effect typically takes weeks to emerge. So increasing serotonin is just the first step in a cascade that eventually leads to downstream changes. Increased neuroplasticity, neurogenesis in the hippocampus, changes in gene expression, modulation of the HPA axis. The therapeutic effect is about the brain's adaptive response to the increased serotonin, not the serotonin increase itself.
Which would explain why different people respond to different medications, even within the same class. If the downstream effects depend on the individual's underlying biology, one SSRI might trigger the right cascade in one person, but not another.
This is where the biotype research becomes practically important. If we can characterize someone's underlying biology, their inflammation status, their HPA axis function, their brain connectivity patterns, we might be able to predict which treatment approach is most likely to work for them specifically. Right now, treatment selection is largely trial and error. The STAR-D study, the largest real-world study of depression treatment ever conducted, found that only about 37% of people remitted on the first antidepressant they tried. Each subsequent step had lower remission rates. By the fourth treatment step, the cumulative remission rate was only around 67%. That means a third of people never reached remission even after four different treatment attempts.
Those numbers are sobering, and it underscores why Daniel's question matters, practically. If you know someone has the more biological subtype, you don't want to spend years cycling through therapies that are unlikely to work while the depression potentially causes cumulative brain changes.
That's the clinical imperative, and it's why the melancholic specifier, for all its limitations, remains clinically useful. If someone presents with clear melancholic features, pervasive anhedonia, lack of mood reactivity, distinct quality of mood, psychomotor changes, early morning awakening, the evidence strongly suggests you should be thinking about biological treatments early and aggressively, not after a year of weekly CBT.
What about the other end of the spectrum Daniel described? People whose depression seems clearly cognitively driven, where they go through a tough period and their thinking gets distorted, and therapy helps. Is there a subtype that captures that?
The closest might be what's sometimes called cognitive vulnerable depression, though it's not a formal DSM specifier. These are people who, when stressed, show characteristic patterns of thinking. Catastrophizing, all-or-nothing thinking, personalization, overgeneralization. Their depression is mediated by these cognitive distortions, and interventions that target the distortions can be highly effective. CBT was literally designed for this pattern. Aaron Beck, who developed CBT, originally described depression as primarily a cognitive disorder with the negative cognitive triad. Negative views of the self, the world, and the future as the core mechanism.
For these people, medication might help too, but the cognitive work is doing the heavy lifting.
Interestingly, some research suggests that for milder to moderate non-melancholic depression, CBT and antidepressants have roughly comparable efficacy in the short term, but CBT may have a protective effect against relapse that medication doesn't provide once discontinued. Therapy teaches skills that persist after treatment ends, whereas medication only works while you're taking it. That said, for severe depression, the combination of medication and therapy consistently outperforms either alone.
The practical takeaway for someone like Daniel is that the distinction he's observing is real and clinically meaningful, but it's not a clean binary. It's more like different profiles on multiple dimensions, melancholic versus atypical, acute versus chronic, inflammation-driven versus HPA axis, driven cognitively mediated versus more directly biological, and people can move between categories over time.
The most important thing is that the treatment should match the profile. If someone has clear melancholic features, don't spend years on therapy alone. If someone has clear cognitive distortions driving their depression, don't assume medication is the only answer. And if someone has tried multiple treatments without success, don't assume nothing will work. There may be a mismatch between the treatment and the underlying biology that a more sophisticated assessment could identify.
One thing I want to circle back to. Daniel mentioned ECT specifically. Is that still a frontline recommendation for certain presentations, or has it been largely replaced by newer options like transcranial magnetic stimulation?
TMS is a newer and less invasive option, and it's effective for treatment-resistant depression, but its efficacy is generally lower than ECT for the most severe cases. For someone with melancholic depression with psychotic features, or someone who is catatonic, or someone who needs a rapid response because they're not eating or drinking, ECT remains the gold standard. TMS is more appropriate for people who haven't responded to a few medication trials but aren't in a life-threatening situation. And then there's ketamine and esketamine, which work through a completely different mechanism. They target the glutamate system rather than monoamines like serotonin, and they work rapidly, often within hours, which is unprecedented in psychiatry.
The treatment landscape is actually expanding. We're getting more options, and the challenge is matching the right option to the right person.
That matching problem is where the research is focused now. There are groups working on blood tests that measure inflammatory or metabolic markers to guide treatment selection. There are groups using EEG or fMRI to identify circuit-level abnormalities that predict response to TMS versus medication versus therapy. It's exciting, even if it's not ready for prime time yet.
What about the people Daniel described as seeming to have depression embedded in their personality? The ones where you just feel like this is who they are. Is there a point where you accept that and stop trying to treat it as an episodic illness?
That's a profound clinical and philosophical question. Persistent depressive disorder is treatable. People with lifelong depression can get better, but the treatment approach might need to be different. The evidence suggests that for chronic depression, the combination of medication and psychotherapy is particularly important, and the therapy might need to be longer term. There's a specific form of therapy called CBASP, Cognitive Behavioral Analysis System of Psychotherapy, developed specifically for chronic depression, and it has good evidence behind it. It's more intensive and focuses on interpersonal functioning and the ways chronic depression shapes how people interact with others.
Even the most entrenched personality-level depression isn't necessarily untreatable. It might just need a different approach and realistic expectations about the timeline.
This is where I want to push back gently on one implication in Daniel's question. The idea that if depression seems embedded in someone's personality, it might be purely biological and only amenable to drugs or ECT. Chronic depression that's intertwined with personality can still respond to psychosocial interventions, but the intervention needs to address the interpersonal and behavioral patterns that have developed over years or decades, not just the acute cognitive distortions. The biology and the psychology are so intertwined in these cases that you really do need to address both.
We should also talk about prevention. If we know that repeated episodes can cause neuroprogression, cumulative biological damage that makes future episodes more likely and more autonomous, then preventing episodes, or treating them aggressively when they do occur, becomes really important.
Every depressive episode seems to increase the risk of future episodes by about 16%. The leading hypothesis involves something called kindling, a concept borrowed from epilepsy, where each seizure makes future seizures more likely. In depression, each episode may sensitize the stress response system, making it more reactive over time. There's also evidence that depressive episodes are associated with reductions in hippocampal volume, and the degree of volume loss correlates with the total duration of untreated depression.
Letting depression go untreated isn't just prolonging suffering. It may be allowing cumulative brain changes that make the condition harder to treat in the future.
That's the implication of the neuroprogression literature. The stakes of getting treatment right are higher than most people realize. It's not just about feeling better now, it's about protecting the brain's capacity to recover in the future.
This connects back to inflammation. If chronic stress and depression increase inflammation, and inflammation worsens depression, you've got another vicious cycle. Are there interventions that target inflammation directly?
There have been clinical trials using anti-inflammatory drugs as antidepressants or augmentation strategies. Celecoxib, A COX-2 inhibitor has shown some benefit in analyses when added to standard antidepressants, particularly in people with elevated inflammatory markers at baseline. Minocycline, an antibiotic with anti-inflammatory properties, has also been studied, and there's interest in omega-3 fatty acids, though the evidence is mixed. More broadly, exercise is one of the most reliable anti-inflammatory interventions we have, and it also happens to be an effective antidepressant in its own right, with effect sizes comparable to medication for mild to moderate depression.
Exercise is an antidepressant. That's one of those findings that sounds like lifestyle advice, but is actually backed by solid evidence, right?
The evidence is robust. Multiple analyses have confirmed that exercise has a moderate to large antidepressant effect. The mechanisms are probably multiple. It increases neurotrophic factors like BDNF, which promotes neuroplasticity. It reduces inflammation. It modulates the HPA axis. It increases endorphins and endocannabinoids, and it provides a sense of mastery and self-efficacy that can counteract the helplessness central to depression. For someone with mild to moderate depression, particularly the more cognitively mediated type, exercise alone can be a legitimate first-line treatment.
For the melancholic, biological type, exercise is probably adjunctive at best.
For severe melancholic depression, telling someone to exercise is almost insulting. These are people who can barely get out of bed. Their psychomotor retardation is a biological symptom, not a lack of motivation that can be overcome with willpower. That's why the subtype distinction matters so much clinically. The same recommendation that's evidence-based and helpful for one person can be harmful and invalidating for another.
Let's pull this all together for Daniel's question. He's observing something real. There are different presentations of depression that seem to have different underlying mechanisms and respond to different treatments. The science supports this intuition, but it's more complex than a simple cognitive versus biological split.
The key points I'd want him to take away are these. First, the melancholic subtype, characterized by pervasive anhedonia, lack of mood reactivity, and psychomotor changes, is the one most consistently linked to biological abnormalities like HPA axis dysregulation, and it responds better to biological treatments including medication and ECT. Second, persistent depressive disorder captures the embedded in-personality pattern, chronic, lower-grade depression that people experience as just who they are, and it often requires combined treatment over a longer timeline. Third, the field is moving toward biotypes based on underlying biology rather than symptom-based subtypes, and this promises to eventually allow personalized treatment selection. And fourth, the psychological and the biological are not separate categories. They're different levels of description of the same system, and effective treatment usually needs to address both.
Practically speaking, if someone has a friend or family member who seems to have the more biological, treatment-resistant type, the message is not to give up on therapy or assume only drugs can help. It's to recognize that the treatment sequence might matter. Stabilize the biology first, then layer on the psychological work. And don't let stigma around treatments like ECT prevent consideration of something that might be effective.
One last thing, because it's relevant to Daniel's question. There's an emerging literature on treatment-resistant depression defined as failure to respond to at least 2 adequate trials of different antidepressants. And the research is finding that treatment-resistant depression is not just more severe depression, it may be a biologically distinct condition. People with treatment-resistant depression show different patterns of brain connectivity, different inflammatory profiles, and different genetic markers compared to people who respond to first-line treatments. So when Daniel observes that some people just don't seem to respond to the usual approaches, he's noticing something the science is increasingly recognizing as a distinct clinical entity.
Which circles back to the biotype idea. If we can identify these people biologically, we might be able to skip the failed trials and go straight to the treatments that are more likely to work, whether that's ketamine, ECT, TMS, or combinations we haven't discovered yet.
That's the promise. We're not there yet, but the trajectory is clear. And I think that's the most hopeful message in all of this. The science is advancing, the treatment options are expanding, and the old idea that depression is either a chemical imbalance or a psychological weakness is being replaced by a much more sophisticated understanding that should lead to better outcomes over time.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact. The collective noun for a group of porcupines is a prickle.
For listeners who want something actionable from this conversation, here's what I'd suggest. If you or someone you care about is dealing with depression that hasn't responded to treatment, ask about the specifiers. Ask whether the presentation has melancholic or atypical features. Ask about the treatment implications of those features. If therapy alone hasn't worked after a reasonable trial, consider whether a biological intervention might be needed to create the conditions for therapy to be effective. And if multiple medications haven't worked, don't assume nothing will. Ask about TMS, ask about ketamine, ask about ECT, and if your clinician dismisses these options out of hand, consider getting a second opinion from someone who specializes in treatment-resistant depression.
I'd add that the exercise finding is worth taking seriously for people with milder depression. It's free, it has no side effects, and the evidence is strong. Not as a replacement for other treatments, but as part of the picture. And on the prevention side, the neuroprogression research suggests that treating depression early and adequately isn't just about relief now. It's about protecting your brain's future capacity to recover.
The other practical point is about how we talk about depression. The false dichotomy between its biological and its psychological has done real harm. It's led some people to feel that taking medication means they're admitting their depression is real, as if psychological suffering isn't real on its own. And it's led others to resist medication because they believe their depression is psychological and should be solved through insight or willpower. The science tells us these categories are not separate. Your psychology is your biology, expressed through your particular life history and circumstances. Treatment can enter at any point in the system and have effects that ripple through the whole thing.
I think that's a good place to leave it. The question Daniel asked, are there recognized subtypes, and is some depression fundamentally biological, has answers, but they're not the simple ones that either the chemical imbalance crowd or the it's all in your thinking crowd would prefer. The science is pointing toward a more integrated understanding, and that's good news, even if it's more complicated.
One open question I keep coming back to, if we do develop reliable biotype testing, how will that change how we think about depression culturally? Will it reduce stigma by making the biology more visible, or will it create new forms of stigma around the biotypes that are harder to treat? I don't know the answer, but I suspect we're going to find out over the next decade or two.
Thanks, as always, to Albert Flumingtop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you found this useful, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon with whatever Daniel sends us next.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.